Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In Haiti, the rescue effort has been called off nearly 2 weeks after an earthquake hit the capital. A man unearthed on Saturday was likely the last person to be pulled alive from the rubble, and now the rebuilding begins. Some are saying that Haiti can now be better and stronger than before. But is that possible?
We need to roll up our sleeves and begin to lay the groundwork for the enormous task ahead. We want to get it done right.
Haitians need shelter now, and the country is the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. What kind of Haiti will rise from the rubble? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, January 25th. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Welcome back, Celeste.
Thank you. I had a restful week away. The takeaway for me in this story, you just heard the Canadian Minister for Foreign Affairs talking about rebuilding Haiti and doing it right this time.
It's not going to be Canada that they're rebuilding. The Haitians are going to have to rebuild the nation in their image.
That's it. We're going to talk about that in just a minute.
Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. First to Washington. The details of President Obama's first State of the Union address. Our partner, the New York Times, has learned that the president will propose a package to help middle-class families, including tax credits for child care, caps on some student loans, and a program to help families care for elderly relatives. Compared to the president's first-year agenda, these proposals are described as modest. But White House advisor David Axelrod tells ABC News there's nothing new in the presidential software.
In Washington, people look for signs, cues for their script to say, here's Obama 2.0. This is the Obama who ran for president.
As for Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell tells NBC News,
if the president wants to govern in the middle, there'll be Republicans there to meet him.
President Obama's first State of the Union address is on Wednesday night.
In Haiti, truckers filling mass graves with bodies report 150,000 bodies have been buried so far. That doesn't count those still under the rubble or carried off by relatives. International aid workers are now setting up tent cities outside Port-au-Prince for earthquake refugees. But there's a shortage of tents right now, with hundreds of thousands more needed. But as this aid worker says, these tent cities are only a short-term solution.
In May, the rainy season begins. In June, the hurricane season begins. You know, a tent is a solution for 3 to 4 months.
For the latest, we're joined now by Ed Pilkington, a New York correspondent for The Guardian. He just returned from spending a week in Haiti. Can you tell us what's happening now?
Yes, I was there for a week and I got out on Friday. And every day you could see things getting a little bit better, a little bit more food on the streets, signs of people clearing the rubble. But I have to say it was agonizingly slow, that the water was arriving very, very late. Food was scarce. You might have a water truck every 1, 2, or 3 miles apart. And wherever we went, we were surrounded by people begging us for information about where to find food and water. So things are still extremely bad.
Is the news of a mass exodus from Port-au-Prince accurate?
Absolutely. On my final day, we went and found them, and there are hundreds of thousands of people quitting the city. You have to say, it's logical. They're getting on buses. They're going back to their homes. Most of these people have come from the countryside in the first place. They're now going home to find food and shelter in their families.
Well, hopefully they will. We're going to talk about that more in just a moment with Ed Pilkington.
So other quick stories. Osama bin Laden, in a new audio message, claimed responsibility for the Christmas Day bombing attempt in Detroit. He also vowed further attacks. U.S. officials say there's no evidence bin Laden knew anything about the plot before it happened, and they're trying to confirm the voice. Top U.S. commander in Afghanistan says a negotiated peace with the Taliban is now the way to end the war, and it was party time in the Big Easy.
Snap.
The New Orleans Saints, a team that was homeless after Hurricane Katrina, they're going to their very first Super Bowl. Oddsmakers have the Colts, though, the other team in the Super Bowl, as an early 4-point favorite. Asian markets down, European indices mixed. Futures are up. The Dow starts at 10,172. The S&P opens at 1,091. The Nasdaq at 2205. We are on the air for 4 full hours here in New York City. Welcome to our new listeners.
Absolutely. And we are going to be talking about the State of the Union all week, and we're looking for your take. We send out a special welcome listeners to in New York, and we're asking you, what do you think is your State of the Union? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeofthetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
It's been nearly 2 weeks since a 7.0 earthquake in Haiti destroyed much of the infrastructure there, and they're finally calling rescue efforts off. Now, the focus of relief aid will switch from treating the wounded to a rebuilding of the crumbled capital there. Where do they begin, and can it be better than ever, as some people say that it may be? We're joined now again by Ed Pilkington. He's the New York correspondent for The Guardian, just returned from a week in Haiti. And also Lawrence Vail joins us, a professor of urban design and planning at MIT. He's co-editor of the book, The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. Good morning to both of you.
Morning.
So, Ed, you were talking about this exodus of hundreds of thousands of people, possibly from Port-au-Prince into the countryside. They're going in search of water, food, shelter. Does the countryside, do the rural areas have that?
Yes. I mean, most Haitians who are living in Port-au-Prince have family back in the countryside. So, and there they'll find houses, they'll find maybe a small plot of land where they're growing their own food. They're self-sufficient. So maybe food will be a little bit scarce, but it's going to be much more plentiful than in the city. That's the sort of good news. It's sort of logical that they're returning to the countryside now. The bad news is that the people I spoke to crowded around bus stops, piling onto these free government buses to go back to the country, are saying to us that within a month, 2 months at most, they're going to come back again. And there's a simple reason for that. There's no work in the countryside for them. There's nothing for them to do. They all came to the town in the first place over the last 20, 30 years in search of work. And that's what they're going to do again. So you've got a very small window, maybe 1-2 months, in which there's going to be a space within the city for repair workers to operate. But within a couple of months, they'll all be back again, and the city will be crowded again, and all the problems of overcrowding and piling in and trying to build shoddy, poorly built houses
the
will start up again.
The tent cities that we saw on hillsides right. and things. So Lawrence Vail, having heard what Ed Pilkington just said, can you kind of put that in perspective for us in terms of disasters? He said we have about 1 to 2 months. Is that enough time to get started on an effective rebuilding strategy?
Well, it's certainly enough time for individuals to get started on what they want to do in a desperate situation for themselves. In some ways, it's a false dichotomy to say there's a rescue period and then a rebuilding period, because the restoration that begins is part of what happens in between. And some of that will be very shoddy and very makeshift, and some of it will be just to get things moving again a bit.
But you've heard people saying, not just Haitian officials, but aid organizations as well, saying this is an opportunity to rebuild Port-au-Prince and rebuild Haiti better than ever. What kind of historical support does that have? Have we seen other cities recover from disasters like this better than before?
Well, first of all, the claim of disaster as opportunity is a kind of classic historic one. You heard it in San Francisco after 1906. We heard it after 9/11. We heard it after Katrina. There's a political necessity to say this. Most recently, the Haitian ambassador to the U.S. Has been repeatedly talking about silver linings, and one can hope that that's the case. There have been dramatic recoveries. Famously, in the U.S., both the Chicago fire in 1871 and the San Francisco earthquake and fires of 1906. Led to tremendous growth and development of those places. They're more relevant, perhaps, to Haiti. There's been some progress in Banda Aceh in Indonesia, a place where 170,000 people are estimated to have died after the Asian tsunami in 2004. 5 years later and several billion dollars of spending, I think most reports I hear are that things have begun to get better.
But Ed, in many of these places where recovery brings opportunity, as Lawrence was talking about, you need some kind of centralized, you know, in China after the government, you have a very centralized organization to get everything done. And in Haiti, the government isn't entirely stable or reliable.
Yeah, I hate to be the voice of doom, but I think all the factors coming together in Port-au-Prince are pretty awesome and pretty negative. I mean, you've got a government that is, at best, fairly non-existent, at worst, has a history of corruption. You've got an incredibly overcrowded city. This is a city with natural confines. It's got these very steep mountains on all sides, so it can't just naturally expand. It's designed for about 400,000 people, with 3 million people living there. And it's also, as we know, one of the poorest countries in the world. And you put all those things together, and I think, on top of that, I'd add, April comes the rains. By about June, you start the hurricane season. People are going to be desperate to get back indoors. And you put all these things together, and the recipe for people just building their own houses, just as they did before, out of breeze box and very thin cement, is going to be intense. And that's what happened last time, and we know what the results have been.
Lawrence, what do you think? Without a strong government to organize the recovery efforts, can they rebuild in a safe way?
This is pretty much a worst-case scenario, because as Ed is saying, some disasters have a great loss of property with relatively little loss of life. Some have great losses of life without completely devastated infrastructure. Some have both kinds of devastation, but have strong political institutions that can direct recovery. And Haiti has none of that. It didn't have that before the disaster struck. So this is a huge challenge. And one can only hope that more parts will be rebuilt with reliable access to clean water and sanitation systems than existed before the earthquake. And one can hope that there will be more awareness of the dangers of building with unreinforced concrete. But the overwhelming needs of so many people who have been living with an informal economy and in an informal housing structure are beyond what anybody can direct.
Ed, what is the chances that we are in the midst of a recipe for repetition of disaster in Haiti?
I'd say extremely high. People are going to be piling back into the city. They've got about 4 months at most before hurricanes start hitting. And they're just going to be doing their own thing. They're used to working without any help, and that's what they're going to do again.
So it's more like Lagos in Port-au-Prince than some sort of futuristic, reimagined Haiti.
Yes.
That's a scary takeaway.
Yeah. Yes, or Nicaragua, where Somoza stole all the money.
Yeah. Ed Pilkington is the New York correspondent for The Guardian. He just returned on Friday from a week spent in Haiti. And Lawrence Vail is the professor of urban design and planning at MIT. He's also co-editor of the book, The Resilient City, How Modern Cities Recover from Disaster. Thanks to both of you. It's 15 minutes after the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
The New York Times is reporting that when President Obama takes the stage for his State of the Union address on Wednesday, there will be a package of modest initiatives, caps on some student loans, tax credits for child care, and a new job creation bill. Moving to health care legislation, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell told NBC News that Congress needs to just go back to the drawing board.
What we really need to do is start over. I mean, the message in Massachusetts was absolutely clear. The exit polls that I looked at said 48% of the people in Massachusetts said they voted for the new senator over health care.
Democrats say core elements of the health care reform plan in Congress remain popular, though.
Looking ahead, the Senate is set to address the country's spiraling budget deficit tomorrow. They'll vote on whether to create a special bipartisan task force to deal with reducing the debt. But with weak support from both sides of the aisle, the bill is expected to fail despite the president's endorsement. The Pentagon is ready to review the records of thousands of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who were discharged with post-traumatic stress disorder. They're trying to determine whether the veterans were wrongly denied benefits. That follows a judge's ruling in a class action lawsuit. And at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a notable Picasso painting will have to undergo repairs after a visitor accidentally lost her balance and tore a 6-inch tear
in the painting.
No, I can't imagine. So look at
when I go to the museum with my kids, I worry about things.
Yeah,
like that.
Coming up, we're going to talk about people making life-changing decisions.
I have a purpose, and I'm able to provide for my family, and not doing things in which would send me away from them again.
We're going to hear the story of Darren McNair for our series The Value in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on news stories we're following this week, and it's time to start with the Fed. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is still waiting to be confirmed for his second term. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said yesterday the Obama administration expects Bernanke to stick around, and Gibbs warned of what might happen.
I think now would be a particularly bad time to send a signal to the international community and to our overall financial system by playing politics in any way with this upcoming vote.
Louise Story-Jones is finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, you've told us, reassured us many times that you didn't think Ben Bernanke was going to face problems in his confirmation.
So we still don't know if he will face problems. You know, it's not like it's gone
it's
to vote.
It's been delayed.
It hasn't passed. But there is a lot of anxiety out there. It's very difficult to read why the vote is held up, because in the last couple weeks, the administration has shifted its tunes on a lot of its policies. So when you see the markets, the stock markets being incredibly turbulent, it's difficult to know if that's because people are afraid Bernanke will not be confirmed, or maybe it's because people are nervous about these new plans that the government has to tax the banks and to impose
populist rhetoric. Yeah.
Right. And so it's very difficult to separate out factors. And of course, we have coming up this Wednesday, the Fed will be making a statement on interest rates. And this Friday, we've got the fourth quarter GDP. So there's a lot of factors here at work. But one thing is certain. The White House is trying to make it clear that they think Bernanke has the vote. Sometimes that's a bit of a, you know, self-fulfilling attempt to push it that way. But all weekend long, they said he had enough votes. That followed reports last week about some senators like Boxer from California and Feingold officially pulling their support from Bernanke. So this is something that's very much in the move, and it would not be safe to say that he is in and it's done till you see the vote.
What do you think about Robert Gibbs' warnings that this is absolutely the worst thing, plain politics over his confirmation is the worst message we could send?
Well, there are people who think that. Of course, Robert Gibbs, you know, is speaking for the administration, and they would like Bernanke to be confirmed.
The markets hate uncertainty, of course. Which
they do.
Is
the markets hate uncertainty, so but when this gets taken care of, it will be good.
Is there a cloud over Timothy Geithner at the Treasury? The financial channels were all over that last week. It sounds like buzz and speculation, but have you ever heard anything?
So Timothy Geithner was interviewed this weekend by Politico, and I was looking at that. And he was asked about Bernanke's future, and he said he thought Bernanke was safe. And then he was asked about his own future, and he said that he would be happy to continue help serving, you know, as long as the president wanted to make progress. So that's what he had to say, and I think the markets will be happy to see some of this get resolved.
One way or the other, right. The markets will be happy when it's resolved. Okay, Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner in the New York Times. Thanks.
So our next takeout poses a real question. So how would we assess the values of a person with a rap sheet like this?
I've sold drugs. I've robbed people. I've actually been convicted of aggravated manslaughter, possession of weapons, multiple drug convictions.
Meet Duron McNair. He's a repeat felon who just got out of prison 8 months ago. And for our regular series, The Value, Takeaway correspondent Farai Chidea spoke with Duron about his job at the Newark Sanitation Department, where he's a refuse collector. And every day, this father of three balances the stability of going straight in a recession economy, even with a low-paying job, and his memories of that life of crime.
Were you living a more flossy life when you were selling drugs? I mean, was that what brought you into the game, or what was it that attracted you to selling drugs?
I believe it was the money and the lifestyle which came with it. It seemed attractive at the time because it was the here and now. I didn't base my life on, well, when my child turns 13, am I able, or are they going to be able to, you know, look back and say, okay, well, I know I got a good dad, or my dad's going to be there.
The value of a life of crime. In fact, McNair spent most of his adult life in prison. His most serious crime was committed when he was still a juvenile.
When I first was incarcerated, it was as a juvenile at the age of 12 years old. And that's when I had the aggravated manslaughter.
What happened?
Well, I was a young guy, and, you know, I grew up in the projects down Dayton Street here in Newark, and, you know, I had access to, you know, weapons and things like that because the people that I knew. And what I did, I grabbed a gun and accidentally shot someone, and I killed him.
That was then. This is now. Duron released from jail 8 months ago, seeking help from the Newark Comprehensive Center for Fathers, where he took a volunteer job, and then he got a full-time job at the sanitation department. His three kids will soon become four. Seeing the value of family, suddenly Duron now finds a purpose.
Well, financial security is definitely a blessing, especially with the economy as it is today. It's given me hope it really gives me a sense of hope just to know that I could wake up in it every morning and I have a purpose. I have a purpose and I'm able to provide for my family and not be away, not doing things in which would send me away from them again.
Will he hold on to that purpose? You can hear more of Farai's interview with Duran and watch a video with Duran McNair at thetakeaway.org where you can see all of the episodes of The Value. And if you want to suggest someone for Farai to interview, someone whose life is actually focused on this issue of where is the value in life, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org and we'll put her right on it.
You can also go to our website to let us know what your State of the Union is. All this week, we're examining the State of the Union with a variety of guests. So Doris Kearns Goodwin, General David Petraeus, Alan Mulally of Ford. What do you think?
Charlie in Harrington Park. Well, the president has spent his first year giving the American people the benefit of the doubt. It's time to stop waiting for us to get it. He has to stop herding cats and start herding the cattle.
What's the state of America and the task for our president? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or, like I said, you can post it at our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to check on the week's agenda with our friends Marcus Mabry of the New York Times and the BBC's Jonathan Marcus. That's coming in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the week's agenda, and it's a big one. It's a doozy. Our friends Marcus Mabry from the New York Times and the BBC's Jonathan Marcus join us in just a few minutes. Right now, top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. A meeting of world leaders in Montreal today will discuss the long-term reconstruction of Haiti. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Haiti's Prime Minister are among the officials who will talk about debt relief and international aid strategies. Lawrence Cannon, the Canadian Foreign Affairs Minister, says it will take a unified effort to rebuild Haiti.
Together with the government of Haiti, we need to roll up our sleeves and begin to lay the groundwork for the enormous task ahead. We want to get it done right.
The international community has pledged more than $1 billion in emergency aid. Organizers of that Friday night Hope for Haiti telethon say that event raised more than $57 million. The first State of the Union address for Barack Obama is Wednesday night, and our partner, the New York Times, says the president will propose a package to help middle-class families, some tax credits for child care, and caps on student loans. White House advisor David Axelrod tells ABC News that the president's declining poll numbers are not surprising.
I said to him a year ago, Mr. President, your numbers are going to be considerably worse a year from now than they are today because you can't govern in an economy like this without great disaffection. And that's what's happened.
And that'll be the backdrop when President Obama delivers his State of the Union address this week. We're asking you to give your own impressions. Describe the State of the Union in six words or less. You can go to our website at thetakeaway.org.
A new message from a haunting old voice. That is purportedly Osama bin Laden in a new audio message claiming responsibility for the Christmas Day bombing attempt in Detroit, as well as vowing further attacks. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs had this reaction on Fox News.
This is somebody that has to pop up in our lives over an audio tape because he's nothing but a cowardly, murderous thug and terrorist that will someday, hopefully soon, be brought to justice.
Gibbs went on to say there's no way to confirm if the voice is really bin Laden's. An audit of a U.S. contract to train Iraq's police force shows poor oversight of more than $1 billion. One example shows the department spending $4 million a year on a security detail to protect six U.S. contractors in Iraq, even though the group already had a team of hired guards. Let's check in on the markets. Asian markets were down, European indices mixed, but futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,172, the S&P opens at 1,091, and the NASDAQ at 2205. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Our government.
Iran.
Your government.
Proliferation.
Public option.
A serious insurgency.
We do have a plan. We're working on
just
it.
Just to give you a sense of perspective.
Perspective. The agenda this week is a doozy. The Obama administration is solidly in Plan B mode after the events of last week and tried to push their way into a jobs message. The question really is the ground moving under their feet? Listen to Valerie Jarrett, senior White House advisor, talking about something we thought was certain, Ben Bernanke's reconfirmation as Fed chairman.
President Obama checked in with the leadership over the weekend, and he heard from Senator Reid that there is a lot of support for Ben Bernanke. We are confident that the chairman will be confirmed.
confident like they were about health care. Marcus Mabry joins us from the New York Times, international business editor, right here in the studio. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning.
And Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent, joins us from Bush House in London. Good morning, Jonathan.
Yes, hi, good morning.
So, Marcus, let me begin with you. It feels like there's a defensiveness suddenly taken over at the White House. They're scrambling to find a message. Obama was in Ohio talking about jobs. We're going to hear the sound of the voice there, and I want to get your assessment of that. But what do you think, Marcus?
Well, you know, this Obama is fundamentally, despite what the right wing says and what some conservative Republicans say, fundamentally a compromise politician. This is a guy who believes in the middle road. He believes actually not in kind of George W. Bush, which was my way or the highway. He came to office with a much greater mandate than George W. Bush, and yet governed not by saying you're going to do what I want. He actually listened to lots of different voices. That what we're going to see right now is a confrontation for Obama. Is he going to be about compromise still, or is he going to be about more my way or the highway?
Well, listen to David Axelrod, White House advisor, who may be getting a bigger role in sort of setting policy as the politicos gather around the president. Here he is talking on ABC News over the weekend.
The president will not walk away from the American people, will not hand them over to the tender mercies of health insurance companies who take advantage. He will not walk away from people with pre-existing conditions. He will not walk away from senior citizens.
Confident or defensive there, Marcus Mabry?
No, absolutely defensive. I mean, the president, you know, he's been talking a lot about fight, fight, fight. I mean, you hear every speech he's been given since Scott Brown's election up in Massachusetts has been about how he's going to fight, fight, fight. It's going to be interesting to see two things to watch in the State of the Union on Wednesday. Number one is the tone. Is he going to take confrontation with the Republicans over compromise? And number two is his actions. Is he going to offer a whole smorgasbord of amuse-gueule, or is he actually going to offer a main course that's about job creation?
All right, Marcus, is it going to sound like this?
I won't stop fighting for an economy where hard work is rewarded. I won't stop fighting to make sure there's accountability in our financial system. I'm not going to stop fighting until we have jobs for everybody.
So
it's going to sound like that, but if you offer a whole half the room will be applauding like that. If you offer the whole smorgasbord of little tiny programs about, you know, helping middle class families save for retirement, helping middle class families pay for child care, does that sound the same as that kind of gusto? I don't think it's going to.
Well, Jonathan Marcus, forgive us. There was a lot on the table there in Washington, but it seems there's a bit of plan B going on in the Afghanistan policy with Stanley McChrystal, the commander there, saying the Taliban will be brought in from the cold. What do you make of this, Jonathan Marcus?
Well, it's a crowded week for Afghan diplomacy. I'm not quite sure that we have the term doozy over here. I think the Foreign Office would say it's a busy and sustained work week of diplomatic effort. Basically, there's a conference in Turkey.
Oh, they're so serious
starting,
over there.
Indeed, starting same language, different terminology, I suppose. But an important conference of regional partners starting in Turkey this week. That's a foretaste for the Afghan conference in London on Thursday. And, of course, I think what we're seeing now is, if you like, an effort to try and turn the coming weeks and months into a sort of a pivotal moment, a moment of change. On the one hand, a sense that the fighting is going to intensify. Sadly, casualties are going to intensify. But the other sense that there is actually no military solution. I think this was clear in General McChrystal's comments. There has to be a political solution. It has to be bringing some of the Taliban elements in from the cold. And the only way to do that is by military force, by a surge, proving to them that they cannot win on the battlefield. The problem, of course, is that President Obama has already announced a deadline, a time after which he hopes to draw down U.S. forces, and some in the Taliban may just decide to wait him out.
And there are no such options in Yemen, which is going to figure prominently at this Afghan conference in London. What's the situation there?
Well, the Yemen conference is the day before. It's a slightly shorter conference arranged at a much shorter timeline. Clearly, the concern is the growing instability and crisis in Yemen, the danger that the country could simply fail completely and provide the sort of haven for Al-Qaeda and other groups that Afghanistan did before 9/11. This is a country of extraordinary problems, the poorest country in the Middle East. Huge levels of illiteracy, poverty, lack of water, oil resources running out. And so this conference is intended both to stump up money, but more importantly, to really get down to the nitty-gritty and decide some key goals in terms of development that have to be achieved and achieved soon.
45 seconds here on the agenda. Jonathan Marcus, take us out on what the Haitian cooperation on the recovery effort means. And I want to get a quick comment from Marcus before we go. Jonathan?
Well, I think it has been a huge effort. The United States stepped up to the mark very quickly. The UN, of course, did so, but equally it has suffered calamitous losses amongst its own people. The key question now is going forward, the long term.
Right.
What can the international community do to stabilize this country in the months and years ahead?
Jonathan Marcus from our partner, the BBC. Take us out, Marcus.
The problem is going to be, is Haiti going to be able to find a government that's actually going to be able to sustain itself and stabilize it after?
That's the rebuilding. The rebuilding of government is as challenging as the shelter. Marcus Mabry, New York Times International Business Editor. There's your agenda.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Celeste, I'm sure it was not a surprise to you that our listeners had lots to say while you were gone.
Not about you, of course. Not a surprise.
But yes, they weighed in very, very heavily on a couple of issues. We want to share them with you. At 8778-MY-TAKE, they completely disagree with that Supreme Court decision on campaign finance spending for companies, unions, and nonprofits.
This is Sarah from Florence, South Carolina. Plessy versus Ferguson, Pennsylvania Coal, Dred Scott, and now this case. All of them dreadful, unconstitutional decisions that were decided based on the politics of the majority of the court.
You know, our listeners always have strong opinions, but that's one of the stronger ones.
Well, she wasn't alone. We've been so overwhelmed by people's responses from around the nation. What's interesting is that so many people are also asking follow-up, rhetorical questions. You know, if a corporation is a person, then what if kinds of things.
This is Drew from Oklahoma City. If corporations are people, does that mean we get to arrest them when they bribe, murder, and commit other crimes?
If corporations have a right to contribute all the money they want to campaigns, then they should be held to citizenship regulations just like the rest of us, and they should have to declare a nation of citizenship and pay taxes to that nation.
My name is Marcia Davis, and I'm from Florence, South Carolina. If the Supreme Court has decided that these corporations can do this, what else can the Supreme Court decide that they can do? I mean, what can these corporations sue ordinary people for that they can have a voice in?
Of course, they're referring there to the principle that was broadened by the court that money equals speech.
Exactly.
And that corporations as people, so-called, have
citizens,
certain rights, including freedom of speech.
But I think what you're seeing reflected there is the same kind of animosity that we see towards banks right now, which may be a result of the economy right now. That's my idea, anyway.
Freedom of bonuses. That's another constitutional.
That's right. I also hear a lot of our listeners thought of this decision in terms of something else that's controversial, and that would be activist judges.
I don't ever want to hear another conservative telling me that there shouldn't be activists on the court because they just got everything they wanted with this activist court.
That's Betty in South Carolina. Meanwhile, James from Red Bank, New Jersey, emailed us at mytakeofthetakeaway.org. He said, how can the Supreme Court equate rights of individuals to that of a structure established solely for business? There was little question before, but now there is clear confirmation we have an activist court. The justices are not calling balls and strikes, a la Justice Roberts' confirmation statement, but making radical changes in the democratic process.
And it's been a change over a long period of time. You know, in the original Constitution, corporations were set up by state charter. They had no rights at all. We've come a long way. Some of our listeners see the decision as a lemon, and others are making lemonade here.
It would be great if we simply sold all the elected positions to the highest bidder, dispersed the money to the needy.
I think that this decision was disgusting. But I think it poses an opportunity. All we have to do is tax the heck out of all the money that's going to go into political advertising, 50% tax maybe, and then, you know, we'll have some extra money to do something with it.
They always have something interesting to say.
Market-based solution.
That's right. If you have your own reaction to the decision or anything else you hear, let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our website, thetakeaway.org. All this week, in preparation for President Obama's first State of the Union address, we're asking you to tell us, what is the state of the union? How do you see the country right now? Describe it for us in a minute or less, six words or less, at 8778-MY-TAKE, or at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, there's no debate over the fact that children are damaged when they experience sexual abuse. There is debate over what causes that psychological damage. We're going to talk more about this controversial subject in just a few minutes. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The president is getting ready for his first State of the Union speech on Wednesday on NBC. Senior White House advisor Valerie Jarrett said the president has used the last year to fix the mess he inherited.
We have pulled it back from the brink of disaster. That was our first and primary goal. The president took some bold steps that were not necessarily popular, but that did stabilize the financial system.
Our partner, the New York Times, says the president will use Wednesday's speech to focus on economic initiatives, including the deficit, job creation, and helping the middle class. In Afghanistan, an official says parliamentary elections, originally scheduled for the end of May, will be postponed until the fall. An official says the elections will be delayed because the Independent Election Commission doesn't have the money needed to pay for the vote. And moving on to some business news, Walmart is cutting more than 11,000 jobs at Sam's Club warehouses.
So talk about aggressive approaches to bank bonuses. In the UK, Goldman Sachs partners, who are based in that country, will have their salaries and bonuses capped at £1 million. That's about $1.5 million, even though bank executives working below partner level will earn much more. Rodney Smith, business reporter for our partner, the BBC, joins us with more on this. First of all, is this an aggressive approach? We've heard taxes of 50%, et cetera, and can they make this stick?
Good morning, John. Well, I don't know about making it stick, but when you consider it from Goldman Sachs' point of view, what they see is legislation happening around the world, or specifically in the UK and the US, and they've decided to bite the bullet in the UK and reduce the bonuses, but only to those who are, so to speak, the most responsible of their people, that is their partners. It means that traders and so on will be able to, probably able to earn significant bonuses over that. Don't fool yourself. The London partners are taking a big hit. In the past, some of these people have taken as much as $160 million home at the end of a year, and they won't be doing that this year.
Now, is there a way for banks to kind of wink and nod and say, okay, this year you'll take a little hit, but in 3 years we'll give you back your $500 million? And is there anything that UK authorities can do about that politically?
Well, in practical fact, that's what the UK authorities are demanding. They're saying of, certainly of several of the banks here, that they must actually look at the future that way, that they're going to have to spin the bonus payments out over a much longer period. Some banks, of course, are grasping this nettle and saying, well, what we'll do is we'll actually pay some of the bonuses in shares. That's fine as far as it goes, but if you're talking about large sums in shares, sooner or later, that's going to come up against some sort of opposition from shareholder groups who will not want to see their stock diluted.
And we'll be watching it. Rodney Smith, business reporter for our partner, the BBC. Thanks so much for that. So in other news, President Obama won't be showing up for jury duty today. White House official says a jury notice was mailed to the president's Chicago address, but he told the court he won't be able to make it. Something about working in a job in Washington that's keeping him away.
Essential personnel type of thing.
You shouldn't bring this stuff into the studio. Bubble wrap.
Oh, yeah. Kids can't
resist it. It turns 50 this month. The spokesman for the company that makes it, it's not just for wrapping breakables. He even knows of a woman who made her wedding dress out of plastic poppers. Bubble Wrap turns 50. Happy birthday, Bubble Wrap. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It's Monday, and on The Takeaway, that means we talk about family today. And today we're talking about a controversial and relatively ugly subject, child sexual abuse. There's conservative estimates out there that say 1 in 5 women and 1 in 10 men in America has been sexually abused as a child, usually by a trusted family member or a family friend. It's also estimated that 95% of victims never seek treatment or report the crime. That's why those estimates are conservative. Dr. Susan Clancy believes there's a way to get more victims to seek help, and that's by changing the way we talk about abuse. She's written a new book called The Trauma Myth, and she joins us from our studios in Boston. We're also joined by Dr. Marilyn Coitra, a professor of psychiatry at NYU, also author of Treating Survivors of Childhood Abuse. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Susan,
good morning.
Two things you establish pretty immediately in your book. One, sexual abuse of children is distressingly common, and two, it always damages the victim. But where you break away from established psychological tradition is in the cause of the psychological damage. Explain.
That's correct. First of all, I want to make clear, I didn't say it always damages the victims. I said that it is a risk factor for all sorts of adult psychological problems. So in most cases, it's damaging, but not always. There are some victims that emerge relatively unscathed. But the main point I was trying to make is that what I think, or what the research seems to suggest, is damaging many of these victims is not the actual event itself, but it is the meaning of the event for these people later on in life. What's damaging is what's happening in the aftermath, how they come to understand themselves and other people around them.
In other words, Marilyn Cloytra, she's saying that it's not necessarily the trauma of the event, that for some of these victims, the event itself was not either violent or traumatic, but dealing with it later. What do you think about this theory?
Well, I agree that there are long-term negative effects for people who have experienced sexual abuse, and I think that's something we've just got to lay out right there for our audience, for every survivor out there. I think the issue of debate is what should we call this experience, and I'm on the side that we should call it a trauma. Even by the most narrow definition of the word trauma in our formal diagnostic system, in the case of sexual abuse, what it really is a threat to the physical integrity of the person, independent of their reaction, right? And this definition helps survivors know what's happened to them, right? Childhood sexual abuse is an experience when an adult takes ownership of the child's body for purposes of their own. And I think we need a definition for survivors to understand what's happened to them, just the way we understand that it's a crime. It's a crime in 50 states. It's also psychologically a trauma to the person.
Susan, your book is based on interviews that you did with victims themselves who described sexual abuse that at the time that it occurred was not, as you say, traumatic.
Right. And I just want to address what Dr. Cloytra is saying. I completely understand the importance of calling this event a trauma from sort of the adult perspective. But the problem is that because of our positioning the event as trauma, but not clarifying details of the event, you end up with a lot of people out there who never report the sexual abuse to anyone and who themselves don't necessarily feel like they were victims because their understanding of the event was when it happened, it was not traumatic. So that's the danger of using a word like trauma. I think we end up overlooking and minimizing the experiences of a lot of people out there who were damaged by what happened, but they're damaged because when it happened, they didn't really understand what was going on and they trusted the perpetrator and they allowed the abuse to happen. And for that, they're paying a price of guilt and shame and isolation as adults.
Dr. Cloytra, you're shaking your head.
Well, I think we have to understand the difference between a reaction to an event, which really varies among trauma survivors, right? They can feel shame, guilt, confusion, fear, and the event itself, right? And
right.
It's really the event itself, I think, that we should focus on and define. And kids may not understand what's happening to them, and I think they don't. And adults who've had this experience also don't understand what's been happening to them. And we need to help, as psychologists, to educate people by giving it a name.
But is part of the takeaway here that there's a separate trauma associated with bringing the perpetrator to justice that might have an impact on the child in this particular case?
Yeah, I think that's part of the idea of trauma, right? Because it is a transgression of a person's basic ownership of their body, right? And once that's understood, right, when we have names for things for kids as well as for adults, we can be unified in an understanding.
But Susan Clancy, your proposition is that if we broaden the definition of it to include those who experienced sexual abuse but for whom it was not violent, that it may encourage them to come
forward.
What
I'm just trying to say is I understand what Dr. Cloytra means, but I'm just saying that the repercussions of this type of positioning is that you have most of the population of sexual abuse victims who aren't reporting their crimes, and most of them saying that they feel guilty and ashamed. And I don't think that the trauma conceptualization is helping them cope with this guilt and shame because it's kind of overlooking their own experiences.
Dr. Cloytra, I mean, how do we come away with 95% of people not reporting it? Is it possible that for some of them it's because it's not traumatic? They don't see the event itself as traumatic?
Right. I think we basically have to distinguish the reaction to the event versus the event. And people can have a wide range of reactions, including feeling okay about it. But that doesn't mean that it was okay. And I think if we label the event a trauma, that's a sort of core definition that people later on can say, oh, something bad did happen to me. If we label a robbery, say, of a woman who's been stolen from, she might like the person, she may not know that it's going on, but years later saying,
right,
That was a robbery.
That's Dr. Marilyn Cloytra. It's an interesting discussion. Cloytra is a professor of psychiatry at NYU, and Dr. Susan Clancy's book is called The Trauma Myth, The Truth About Sexual Abuse of Children and Its Aftermath.
If you want to weigh in on this subject, you can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Welcome to our new listeners here in New York on the AM signal, AM 820. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.